Breckening podcast by Brian Breckenridge. Got another episode for you. I got an interview that I'm very excited about. With me, longtime pal, Todd Camp. There's a lot you can say about Todd Camp. Let's just go back with how we've met. I like to start there, especially with someone such as a storied past. I even have like a list of things I like to talk about. We first met in the DFW comedy scene. You were hosting an open mic at
Percussions.
I'm blanking. Percussions.
Percussions, yeah.
Which was a bar in Fort Worth, down the street from us. We're at Todd's house right now. I'll call it a low key gay bar.
Yeah, very low key.
It's called Percussions because all I could tell was there was like a French horn on the wall. Why was it called Percussions?
Yeah, I honestly don't know where they came up with that name. I know they used to have like there was like music on the wall. There was like a staff, and it had notes and stuff all over the walls. I don't know if it was like meant to be a jazz club at one point. But it was opened as a gay bar. Before that, it was a strip club.
Okay. And it was just down the street from the former, now currently burned down vacant lot, the Rainbow Lounge.
Absolutely.
And so you and our buddy Kyle ran an open mic there. And that was back in like the DFW comedy days where shit was a fucking party.
Absolutely.
So many late, I believe Tuesday nights maybe was the day.
I think it was Tuesday, yeah.
Tuesday. And we would just have a blast on those. Also, y'all made it a competition.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd all try to win $50, and
it was like $100.
Oh, $100!
Yeah, we were
going
$100, yeah, because it was like I remember you guys were all like, "Holy shit, $100!"
Yeah, I will go there.
Yeah,
I will go there and try to win that monies. And so that's where we all, you brought and there that day there wasn't too much in Fort Worth for stand up comedy wise, let alone open mics.
Yeah, really,
let alone a way to make money. And that's where we, first hit it off, and then I got to learn a lot about you at. So, Todd Camp, where do you start off at? That's where we met, mm-hmm. and then I got to learn a lot about you. But about you is a weighted question. There's a lot to learn about you. So where does it all start with you, sir?
Well, funny that we met through the world of comedy, because comedy was something, I was into comedy, stand-up comedy, all kinds of different sorts of comedy.
Hold up a little bit more that way. There's some little right. noise. I'll hold up a little bit more on the mic stand that way.
Oh, okay.
Put your hand
okay, here we go.
A little bit more.
Is that better? I need to choke up.
You just got to worry about like wires hitting shit.
All
and
right.
That'll be fine.
I know I should learn to choke up on these things.
Hey,
I should be a pro at this point now. Now it's like for me, stand-up comedy was in my DNA from back in the days when I was a little kid. I remember my dad would buy, he bought me Steve Martin's Let's Get Small, like when it was brand new. Mm. And so we would sit and listen
to
Steve
Martin, that's a comedian.
He's a stand-up comic. Maybe you may have heard him. Some people may have. He's better known now as the star of Only Murders in the Building. But before that, he was, the first superstar comedian. And so his albums were like, for me, as I grew up, we watched Saturday Night Live from the very beginning. And that was... I remember that Steve Martin hosting SNL was appointment television. I mean, if there were plans, they were canceled. My family, we watched that. It was back in the day, you didn't have VCRs, you didn't have any of that stuff. Mm. You could only see it live. You missed it.
Yeah.
And you'd have to wait for reruns 100 years later or whatever. But so that was, Steve Martin was everything to me, and my dad absolutely adored him. So he bought each one of those albums brand new. We would sit there, father and son just listening and laughing our asses off at the stuff. So comedy was in my DNA. I had tried it in college, but I think I was more of a comic actor. So I think that was meant to be. I'd done some improv and things like that, but stand up was always just a little bit out of my realm. But Kyle and I had both been passionate fans of stand up, so we wanted to give a home for comics to come in, and we had that Percussions show. I think it was called It Only Makes Me Laugh. I think it was the first show that we had, and I look back on, I found a video that we'd kind of done as like a promo video for the show, and we had so many amazing comics back in that day, many of whom have gone on to New York and LA, and Some were still kicking around the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but yeah, that was so much fun.
Oh, dude, that was a definite yesteryear.
Absolutely. The scene.
You personally, where's it all start?
I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas, the sparkling city by the sea. One of the ugliest cities in the state of Texas. I hate to say it, but it's just gross. But yeah, I went there. I stayed in Corpus up through high school, and then I came to Fort Worth to attend TCU back in 1980-something. And never
10
left.
Years in college.
No. Absolutely. Yeah, it was... But I came here for TCU, and my grandmother was the head librarian at TCU, which is why I came. So it was Fort Worth was just my kind of town. I liked it. It's a big city, but it didn't feel like a big city. So
especially then,
like absolutely.
Now it's definitely grown over the years, which you've personally seen. But you know, back then it's always been known as like the gateway to the West.
Yeah.
And, you know, always had like a downtown, you know, always little sibling to Dallas and all that. But it was always the city that wanted to do more and try more. And
that downtown was a little dicey back in the day.
Oh,
I remember when I was at TCU.
All right,
yeah, it was like you had Caravan of Dreams and you didn't walk anywhere than like within a 3-block radius of Caravan of Dreams for fear of
Bass Hall then, I guess.
No. Yeah. This is pre everything. Yeah.
So you have a long you have a history. You're a gay man. Let's just get that out there.
Wait, I'm what? I'm
sorry to inform you. Oh no!
Thanks for outing me, Brian. All right, cool.
Oh,
shit, now I guess everybody knows.
You have I want to say, I don't know if it's the best word. I want to say you're like a one man historian, as other people involved, but you're like a historian of the history of the LGBTQ community and. You know, it's Fort Worth, maybe even like DFW, but probably more Fort Worth.
Yeah, Tarrant County. I think I tend to focus on that a little bit most.
And you've your creative endeavors have definitely bridged into there, and also just there's so much. You've done so much. It's a hard place to start. Always been gay. But you've also have a hand in that community. And the giving like a voice to their representation, but also you've done had a hand in like movies, like producing, directing, acting, something like that, right? Or
oh yeah,
and all of it, I assume.
Oh yeah. Where do you want to start first?
Shit, man. All right, let's go with the list.
Okay.
Let's go. Okay, let's start with. Let's just go top down with So your latest thing, and we can go back in history. Your latest thing right now, we can dive into that, is Yesterqueer.
Right. So
what is that?
So back during COVID, everybody was kind of looking for something to do to keep their brains occupied while we were all stuck at home. So I had started a Facebook group called the Fort Worth Gay History Project, and so. You know, before that, I was the artistic director of Q Cinema, the Fort Worth Gay and Lesbian International Film Festival, and I was artistic director for 14 years. During that run, I came up with this idea that I really wanted to start documenting our history, and I began collecting material. I was particularly interested in the history of LGBTQ nightlife, so I was really interested in the bars. And while there are a lot of people in the community who are not necessarily wanting to be associated with bars and what happens in bars... I recognize the fact that gay bars were, for all intents and purposes, a huge focal point for the gay experience. Gay bars were, in many ways, like what black churches were to the African-American community. These were not just gathering places and places to drink. They were places to, meet potential partners. When AIDS reared its ugly head, it was places of education and eventually places of mourning. So these spaces,
it's not just a bar; it's a community.
Absolutely,
it's a focal point, the community center, almost de facto. Because again, the place.
Yeah.
We're going here, and we're going to go to this bar afterwards to talk about what we just did and what we're going to do.
Well, in many cases, they were safe havens. They were the only place you could go to truly be yourself.
No,
because
absolutely.
We're talking about days when
you
couldn't be out at work and you couldn't really tell all your friends, and it was just a different time.
Back when being out, like, what's funny is this day, like, you have such broad range of lifestyles and identities. And now, like, but that's like a term that almost kind of has faded away, being out.
Exactly.
Like, people will be out. But, like, again, being out was not a thing. Like, it was a risk. That was, you had to be, like, I assume very brave to be out at, you know, day job.
Absolutely.
On your day to day.
Well, you could still legally be fired back in those days.
Yeah,
I mean, technically, it's still not illegal to be fired from your job in the state of Texas because you're homosexual. It's pretty much become passe. I think, you know, there are a lot of companies, you know, I work for American Airlines, which is, you know, one of the most gay positive organizations in the country. And they, there are a lot of, any major corporation worth its salt is not going to going to have anti-discrimination policies in place. But there are a lot of small businesses. Now, you could still lose your job. They may not say that's why you lost your job, but that's why
they'll
you lost your
reason,
job. Yeah. They'll find a reason. So I started out with that in mind, and I had collected a lot of material. So during COVID, I had already started a little Facebook group to just kind of discuss things, but I'd let it kind of go by the wayside. And during COVID, I picked it back up again and just started posting and sharing materials that I had collected. And I saw this huge spike, and, you know, the number of group members doubled and doubled again and doubled again. And so it got, you know, I think we reached 1,000 before COVID ended, which was great. I had no idea that that many people were interested. So I, when COVID finally lifted, I approached Jenna Hill over at Liberty Lounge and
Higgs.
Said,
"Oh no, Hill, Hill. Oh, no, is that her?
Jenna Higgs. Hill. Jenna Hill Hicks.
Ah, same thing. Sorry. Yeah.
Jenna. We approached Jenna,
owner of Liberty Lounge,
yes.
A local gay bar.
Right."
Former 515 bar.
But
she
515.
Gave it like a proper name instead of just the address name, which is Kurt Bar. Love that place.
Yeah. Gay bars love to be lazy. We had so many bars that were just, you know, the 651, which is one of the oldest bars in town. I'm like, can we not use the street address?
Which isn't even the current address, but give it a name, damn it.
Come on, be original. We're gay. We're supposed to be creative, for God's sakes. I went to her and I said, hey, I'd like to try and do like a happy hour. And just my goal at the time was just, I wanted to get some of the older people in the community to come out and share stories. Cause I was really wanting people to tell me the things, you know, I'm an older gay man, but I'm in my 50s and I wanted the 70s and 80s to come out and tell me stuff that was long before my time. Cause I didn't come out until, God, the early 90s. I was 26 when I first came out. So
okay.
I was a late bloomer. And so Jenna was like absolutely thrilled with the idea. So we did our very first one in April of 2022. And it was really just about the history of that little area that her bar was in, which was called the South Jennings Crossroads. Because there was a guy named Billy Ray Hill who had owned a number of bars in that area. And his goal was to turn that area into the Fort Worth neighborhood, along the lines of what Cedar Springs is in Dallas. So we talked a little about the history of that, and we had a great crowd. People loved it. And so it was the same kind of thing that we had with Facebook. We started seeing the crowd double and double and double up to last 2 weeks ago. We did one on the history. I think the topic was where the girls were, what happened to the Tarrant County lesbian bars. So we had 75 to 100 people show up for that one, which was insane. It was packed. We were on the patio. It was amazing. So it's been a real eye-opener for me, and people are finally coming around to what I'm trying to do. We're getting a lot more donations in terms of items for the archive that we're trying to build. So it's been an incredibly rewarding project, and people are really embracing it, and not just older people. We're seeing a lot of young people. College kids are coming out, and they're just astounded. And I've been trying to explain it to people, the reason why we're doing this, and having these kids there is important, because we're seeing the same shit happen. You know, the stuff that we fought in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and 90s, they're doing the same tactics again. It's coming back around. Now it's hitting trans people. Now it's hitting gays and lesbians again. And so I'm trying to say, like, hey, here's what we did the first time this shit reared its head. So maybe you can learn from this and, you know, could teach us some new tactics. But we had I went to an event recently on Monday, and they were doing a drag show at a little bar called Tulips, and it was a fundraiser for LGBTQ Saves, which is a queer youth organization. And we got wind that there was a couple of organizations that were going to come out protest. So they spread the word. And I went out there Monday. And of course, it was the day we had this shooting in Nashville, which really had me kind of on edge and worried about some kind of backlash we were going to see. And, you know, we had like 8 protesters. And then we had, I don't know how many people. The bar was packed.
Yeah, they had single digits, and I heard y'all had triple digits.
Oh, it was insane. Yeah, and they raised close to $10,000. It was incredible, and it was an amazing show. It was just. I wanted to be there. I just felt like I needed to be there to experience that, and it was. So I don't know. I'm constantly going through this phase of being disappointed in humanity, and then having my faith in humanity restored. That was one of the faith restored kind of evenings. So.
And it's local and it's personal. And so
absolutely.
I think that means the most out of just seeing like some nice story, you know, online. No, it's something you could see and it's real, it's visceral, it's right in front of you. And that I think has the best positive impact than just, you know, seeing like, oh, nice story online. Because you're not there, you're just reading words in someone else's account. And you getting the history together, especially because this is a history that, you know, it can't just be on a Wikipedia page. It can, but it's like, I kind of equate this with like growing up in Irving and, you know, my fellow, you know, people my age and the mall rats that were at the Irving. Us and other people that went to Irving Mall can piece together the history of different stores and how the food court was assembled. That, you know, might be in some documents somewhere that nobody cares about anymore, and those documents might be done. It takes us to piece it together. Now, on a much more important level is what you're doing instead of the history of just some fucking mall. But that's, you know, you getting people before you from the 70s and 80s and what they had to go through with the, you know, gay and lesbian community then, and then what you saw, and then, you know, bringing all that back around to today and, you know, the things you can learn.
And you know, you talk about it's just a fucking mall. It's like, this is just a fucking bar. But it's like the idea that, you know, in some of these little tiny shithole bars, some really important things happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just remember telling a story from that one of the very first ones. We were talking to, and we had a bunch of college kids in the audience, and we were talking about how, yeah, there used to be a little tiny hole-in-the-wall bar north on Jacksboro Highway called... El Toga, and Jerry Cassidy, better known to most people as Big Mama, who was a bartender, he worked the door, and they had literally had one of those, you know, this place, this was a former, you know, gangland hideout, you know, back in the day when Jacksboro Highway was all gang bars you know, prohibition style era bars. And so they had one of those sliding slots on the door, you know, like thin slot that you slide open, you could just see eyeballs. And so Jerry would look at the parking lot, and if he saw cops pull into the parking lot, he would flash the lights so that all the men would grab a lesbian and start dancing with them.
Wow.
So when the cops came in, they wouldn't be arrested for being gay.
Yeah.
And I just watching the looks on these kids' faces, like, is this true? And I'm like, yeah. Yeah, kids, this is in my lifetime.
Yeah.
It's just, this is not ancient history we're talking about.
Men and women
we're talking
dancing.
About the late 60s and early 70s. So it's like a lot of the people in this room remember that. And that's, it's crazy to think that that's the kind of stuff that used to happen. But, you know, I didn't think that I would ever see something like that. And then, you know, I was at the Rainbow Lounge the night the Rainbow Lounge was raided on the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots, a movement that began from police harassment of gays in a New York bar. And then they came in and busted a bunch of people, sent a kid to the hospital with a brain injury. It's like,
what was their like reasoning for raiding the Rainbow Lounge?
I think they had, Rainbow was brand new. It hadn't been open a week.
Oh, wow.
And it was, they had been to 2 other bars. They'd been to an African-American bar and a Hispanic bar. And I think they'd had some trouble there. The patrons had fought back, and so when they got to us, they were really pissed off. And they were just kind of looking for a fight. And it's like, this is not the place. You know, it's like, we don't have bouncers here. There aren't bar fights here. So they were just mad. I mean, I observed it that night. I was just like, why are they so angry? Nobody's doing anything. And they would just, you know, grab people, spin around, put them in zip ties, drag them out to paddy wagons. It was like, what the hell is going on?
What? When was this?
This was 2009.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, because of that, because I was, it was my birthday that night. I was there with all my friends, everybody from the film festival. And because they did it in front of a bunch of people who were a little more savvy and plugged in, I was a journalist. My friend was an accountant. My other friend Kyle was a social media expert. It was a lot of people that was like, you just really fucked up in front of the wrong group of people.
Yeah.
And I,
sorry, bitches. We got skills that
absolutely.
Are just
and I we also happen to know that it was the 40th anniversary of the Stonewall Riot.
Yeah.
So it's like, I called CNN. I was calling everybody I knew, and it made national and then international news in a matter of hours. So the city had a huge black eye, and they had to make it go away as quickly as possible. And, you know, we presented 15 demands. They met all 15 demands eventually.
Oh.
So it we became kind of a role model for the country. Like, how did you get all of this amazing stuff, groundbreaking, you know, legal, you know, things taken care of in such a short period of time? And it's like, you know, it was wrong time, wrong place, but
in a damn
right
good
time
community.
For us. Yeah. Yeah.
Let alone who are, you know, plenty of those were witnesses of this specific event.
Right.
So
it was crazy.
Fort Worth PD, their spokesmen and PR people were probably a little busy around there.
Yeah. And they stumbled a lot at the beginning, but they eventually came around and they made it right. And they realized that what they'd done was wrong. And we, you know, I was running the film festival at the time. I called a filmmaker, a friend of mine, who came over and began documenting everything on video from the get-go, and he made a, you know, feature-length documentary that is it's, you know, it's on multiple streaming services now, and it's brutal. It's hard to watch.
What's the name of it?
It's called Raid of the Rainbow Lounge.
Okay.
And it's hard to watch now because it was the people being interviewed, it is so fresh, and the emotions that he caught from people are so real and so raw that it's hard to not be impacted by it. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, I'm super proud of what we did. I'm proud of the city. I'm proud of the Fort Worth Police Department for stepping up, admitting they made mistakes, and doing what they could to fix it. So it can, there is the possibility of positive change is always on the horizon. So
you're at the forefront of that, and you still are. You have been for a long time. You weren't just this awesome guy to go do a open mic, right, where we could probably win $100. Just the getting to know you more, and then, you know, me being, you know, close by in Arlington, being out in Fort Worth, and just every time we, you know, hang out and everything, I'm like, oh, this Todd guy is pretty fucking rad. And not just a guy who's really cool to, you know, crack jokes with. And just, that's one thing I've just learned from you. Just some, like, and that's one thing I really, you know, was like, oh, zeroed in on you, because I'm like, I want to document, you know, kind of myself. Yeah, you know, selfishly, because I have a podcast, but also this is also the reason I want you on here. And currently have you on here, so, you know, we can go through all this. This is, you know, fucking rad. Like, I kind of remembered some stuff about the Rainbow Lounge raid, but I, yeah, again, you know, this information. So you mentioned at the time, so we got Q, like, was that Q Cinema? Was that so you had people at the time, you know, let's say 2009. You're involved with Q Cinema.
Yeah, so Q Cinema actually started
Let's go into that.
Okay. Let's talk about Q Cinema, shall we? So Q Cinema goes back to probably 95 or 6. And I had graduated from TCU, and I had a friend who was working for the Tarrant County Lesbian Gay Alliance, and she reached out to me about doing a film screening. And we did a film screening of The Birdcage, which I was brand new at the time. And that kind of inspired me to start a film discussion group called Queer Cinema, which I did at TCU, and we would do like a monthly, I was like going through Vito Russo's The Celluloid Closet, which was like the, you know, the pinnacle book written about queer film. Mm-hmm. And so I was picking a lot of really obscure gay films that most people never had a chance to see. A lot of them weren't on video. I had to hunt for them. So we would show these movies and then have a discussion about them afterwards. And that kind of birthed the idea of launching a full-fledged film festival, which we did in 1999. So it was a weekend-long film festival. We changed it to Q Cinema because we figured the newspapers wouldn't print the word queer, which is why in 2023, I deliberately called my organization Yesterqueer.
Yeah.
Because it's like, damn it, I'm going to get the word queer out there. It means something. It's important. But the, so the film festival began, and that, you know, I had, having, I worked at the Star Telegram at the time. I was a film critic. I was able to woo some of the major studios, or at least some of the indie studios that were releasing queer films, to let us show stuff. So our very first year, our debut film was a movie called Trick, which was a big film for New Line Cinema, the house that Freddy Krueger built. And, you know, we followed it up with stuff like Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And we would get these, you know, major studio films mixed in with a lot of really indie stuff. And I was talking about somebody, talking to somebody on Monday, and I says, running a film festival was a truly joyous experience for me, because back in the day, you could show, that for me to define these things, see them, be impacted by them, and then have the ability to share them with an audience was so much fun. I mean, because I would see things that would touch me, or I would laugh, or, you know, repel me or whatever, and then I could pass it on to another audience. And so that, I love doing that. We did it for 14 years. My husband at the time was the technical director, and, you know, my best friend Kyle joined it. There was a lot of people in my immediate circle of friends who that was their life for 14 years until I decided to retire. But yeah, that was a really fun time of my life. Film's always been a huge part of my life. So,
oh, being a film critic, I can only assume.
And then I made three awful movies when I was in college. So,
Nate, well, what were these awful movies?
When I was a senior at TCU, TCU was unrecognizable compared to what it looks like now. And we lived in a dorm called Tom Brown, which is an all-male dorm. And we made a movie called Carnage Hall. We had a club in the dorm called the Carnage Committee. We would watch every awful VHS horror film that the local video store had. And so we'd watch all these bad movies and go, you know, I bet we can make a better movie than
this. We can
make
a better bad movie.
Absolutely.
We're in college. We got the know-how. We
sure.
Maybe, yeah.
So sure enough, we made a bad movie. But it was, you know, and none of us were radio TV film majors, so the radio TV film department wouldn't let us use any of their equipment.
Oh, boo.
And But we found a guy who had, like, you know, one of the big over-the-shoulder, you know, put the VHS tape in it and close it. And we made this film, and we shot it during almost close to the end of the senior year. And because we shot the entire film, and it was an hour and a half long movie, so the radio TV film department was so impressed that we made an hour and a half long movie
without their help,
and their students couldn't even finish a 2-minute music video. So they're like, all right, you can use our equipment to edit it.
Yeah.
So we edited it, and we screened it during Dead Days, which are the study periods for finals. And they came to the screenings, and they loved it. It's still, of the three movies we made, it's probably the worst, but it's my favorite, because it's, none of us knew what the hell we were doing. None of us were actors. Most of the people in it are drunk at the time. But it's still funny as hell. It's still a very good representation of what TCU was like at that time, not only what the campus looked like, but what just campus life was like. And I screened it for a bunch of my friends from the chat room and the little bar that I go to on a regular basis. And it's still funny. I mean, it still holds up. And oddly enough, we did a sequel the year after I graduated called Postmortem, Return to Carnage Hall. And then the third movie we did was called Something of Mine. And I was telling you earlier, we got a call recently that a distributor wants to release it. So
the first Carnage Hall, or
the third film we did, which was Something of Mine. But they want Carnage Hall and Postmortem as well.
Oh.
They've seen all three of them, and they want them. So Carnage Hall is like, I'd love to do it. I've got to completely rescore it, because it's nothing but ripped off music from other composers.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Postmortem was an original score, so we're working on that.
Copyright
next.
Claims on that.
Absolutely.
Shit,
I don't want Danny Elfman to sue me, because it's literally every Danny Elfman score up to that point.
Unless you're like, can we talk about it? Can you come to Fort Worth and
I've talked to Danny a few times. I'm like, I think I did tell him at one point. It's like, yeah, I made a really awful movie and used all of your music up to that point. So who knows? Maybe he'll cut me a deal.
Oh, maybe. So how did a Q Live come out of Q Cinema?
Kyle and I, Kyle Trentham is one of is my best friend. He who lives next door, by the way. He and I were.
Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Kyle. We were both theater people, so I had done a lot of like local theater for a while, and he and I got the idea that we should start a theater company. So I think our very first show was we did the play, the original play that the musical Spring Awakening was based on, and we did it at whatever the center is right next door to Bass Hall. So Spring Awakening was playing at Bass Hall, and
Cheesecake Factory.
No, it was Cheesecake Factory. Yeah, what a great place to do a space. No, it's that rehearsal hall space that they have, and we did it there, and it was a huge turnout. Everybody loved it. The original play is actually really good. And we did a number of productions, but one of the spinoffs of all of our theatrical stuff was doing a live stand-up show. So that was kind of where the idea of It Only Makes Me Laugh, and then it became, gosh, what else? We had so many names. Too Soon. Soon was my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I love like Too Soon.
Yeah, that's a good name for anything. Comedy shows can have... They can have the most basic name, which I've been guilty of, or they can have like a fun sounding name. Like the place I did a show, I retired the show December 2022 at Dr. Jekyll's Beer Lab.
There you go.
In Pantego. Mm-hmm. The first time I did shows there, it was literally just comedy night at Dr. Jekyll's and the most basic flyer known to mankind. But then later on, when I revisited the idea and started doing shows there again, there's new owners, this younger guy, John Valentine, who's one of the owners now. Awesome dude. He's a musician as well. We had a brainstorming session, and I was telling him about, I was like, you know, there's these shows in Austin that have, you know, like some fun names. There's a weekly show at the Fallout Theater. This guy, Brendan K. O'Grady. He really likes the K in his name. And Duncan Carson. They have a weekly show called Sure Thing. And I'm like, oh, that's a good name for a show. And they do a weekly show. I've done that a few times. I'm in Austin. You know, and they'll put me on. And then my buddy Chris Telez, from Dallas originally, been in Austin for a long time. He has a monthly show called Shit's Golden. And I was like, these are fun. You have like a fun, weird, quirky name for a show. And that's why, and me talking to John one day at Dr. Jekyll's, and we kind of use like a modern parlance of the show, that's why they called the show I'm Dead. Mm-hmm. And on the flyer was a crying skull emoji. And the joke was, when I go on stage, I hosted them, and I'm like, if this show title makes no sense to you, it's probably because you're under 45. Or, you know, I pick an arbitrary date like that, because when something's super fucking funny on the internet and you're of a younger age, instead of like saying ha 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 or LOL, which is something I might do,
right?
Even younger than me, I'm 38. Like, they'd say, like, that's so fucking funny, it killed me. You know, something being funny, it kills. Mm-hmm. It killed so hard, I'm dead now.
Right.
And then I'm dead plus crying face emoji plus skull and crossbones emoji. So we just combined all that into a show. Mm-hmm. And just that's why it became I'm Dead, you know, a comedy, a subtitle, a comedy showcase. And so it needs to have like a fun, I like it if it has a fun name. You know,
I miss the day of like the days of the really fun comedy places, you know, like TJ's Chuckle Hut, or we don't have those anymore, unfortunately. So I think we were the second place we went to was Best Friends. That was where it was Too Soon. And then we were in Randy's Club Cherries in Dallas for a while.
You know what's funny is literally last night I was talking to, I went to Grandma's here, did the open mic. I was talking to Ryan Perio.
Oh, yeah.
And I totally forgot about Cherries.
Really?
And then he brought that up, and then I was like, oh, shit, unlocked a door in my mind, and all those memories came flooding back in. And I mentioned, there's another comic there, and I talked about Randy's Club Cherries.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first of all, Cherries had a logo that was, there was a dick and balls in the logo, right?
Sort of, yeah. It was like with a pair of cherries as the balls, I think that was.
Yeah, and then, there wasn't a Y in there. There was a pair of balls at least.
Yeah.
In the title. And then it was the hardest place to do comedy because of just how the place was already.
Yeah, it was an odd shotgun type bar. Yeah.
This was, let's say it maybe Tuesday night as well.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday night at a bar is hard enough for the bartenders. So we have open mic. Again, we're just comics from various backgrounds just want to do. We're mostly used to dive bars and not, you know, nothing. And it's a Tuesday night. Expectations are low. But they, gay bar, cherries, balls, maybe dick and balls in the logo. Tuesday night, they would have a guy in a Speedo, tube top shot, you know, test tube shots, like it's a fucking Friday.
Mm-hmm.
And then not only are you on stage, now not in use and not turned on, literally to the right, you know, you're on stage, you look to the right, there's a fucking shower room.
It was a shower room, yeah.
And
you can go for a private shower with a dancer. Or dancer would, like, take a shower in front of you. Yeah.
And, okay. All right.
That's comedy gold. I'm sorry. I don't know what you're talking about, Brian.
Which was great, but also the reason.
We also had a drag queen co-host, too.
And so everything around you was already outlandish.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was like, oh, I'm going to go up there and talk about, you know, candy bars or something. So nothing you did in a stand-up routine compared to what was going on around you. So that was, I'm going to say that was very unfair, Todd. Very unfair to us comics, just trying to work out a bit for a bunch of randos at a comedy club. We can take that, you know.
It was not our best venue.
It was still, what's great though, is that it's hilarious to talk about.
Oh,
it
yeah.
was great because I completely forgot about cherries because it was that. And then we went to Best Friends, now Urban Cowboy. I believe that's the timeline.
Yep. And then we were in Embargo downtown, which was like a Cuban restaurant.
With amazing food. That place, I didn't realize it had food until the
bartender was called Casa de Jaja.
Not the best title.
It was our salute to, you know, like cheesy comedy club.
But I like the place. The place was kind of nice.
The place was great. That was one of my favorite venues. And they just kind of mysteriously went out of business one night and didn't tell us when we all showed up.
Oh.
And the door was locked. So we're like, I guess we're not doing a show anymore. Okay, cool.
Yeah. And then, yeah.
Cool.
Again, that's when I fell in love with the torta. My favorite food items to this day. That was Connor the bartender,
yeah.
Oh, we would get trashed with Connor.
Absolutely.
He was a good time drinking bartender. That's when I meet bartender. I hate when I'm at a dive bar and your buddies with the bartender and it's like they can't drink with you. You're like, what? Why? Oh, well, one, you're working. And I get why some places are like, no.
Sure, I'm sure it's illegal, but, you know, whatever.
Yeah, there's always some bartender that ruins it. You're like, oh, but I like when my bartender's my drinking buddy. And
absolutely.
Just like, yeah, but they got to work and be somewhat responsible.
Yeah, especially if TABC walks in.
Yeah, that also can put a damper on the
absolutely.
Evening. But oh, fucking cherries. That I was like, oh, I'm going to cherries because I like everyone that's going to be there. But I'm not going to accomplish anything comedy-wise, and I'm not going to have fun for the 5 minutes I'm on stage. But you know what? Fuck it. Let's go.
Kyle and I were, like, over that show because we would, you know, we would close the show, like, close to 2 a.m. sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'd drive back home because we both lived in South Fort Worth. And we had so many conversations. It was like, do you remember passing Arlington at all? I don't remember passing. I was like, this is dangerous. We need to stop doing this show.
Well, luckily, we're right down the street from the house. So
absolutely.
Fuck it. Yeah.
We could just stumble home if necessary.
Too many of those nights.
Absolutely.
Myself, luckily.
Not proud.
Okay. Thank God for those bumps on the shoulder. That wakes you right back up. Brrr, oh, shit.
I'm up.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Okay. That unlocks some caffeine in me
mm-hmm.
for a little bit. So you also work for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
Yeah, I was at the – well, I worked for the Daily Skiff at TCU when I was there, and then I worked for 2 years at the Denton Record Chronicle. It's so hard for me not to call it the Denton Wretched Comical, which is what we called it when I worked there. And then I went to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and I was there for 18 years. So that was like a huge part of my life. I mean, I majored in journalism. I really thought I was going to like – die of a heart attack at my desk in my, you know, 60s or 70s, like every hardcore journalist. And when I got laid off because, you know, the newspaper business went down the toilet thanks to the internet, I was literally rudderless. I had no idea what the hell I was going to do. And, you know, I my current job, a friend of mine recommended me that I try it out and was in marketing. And I'm like, what the hell do I know about marketing? And he's like, you marketed a film festival for 14 years. It's like, okay. Thankfully,
you marketed stories as a journalist. It's,
true.
It's sadly
yeah.
similar.
Well, and they were looking for a word person, which is like, okay, I can do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I work in a very jargon heavy industry. So it was just like, I said to them, if you can make me understand it, then I can make anybody understand it. So that's been like a fantastic relationship. But yeah, I miss those days of the Star Telegram. Again, comedy roots. I covered comedy. I interviewed every legend that I ever worshipped. Steve Martin, Robin Williams. I would talk to George Carlin every single year. He would come. Yeah. And I remember Carlin was my guy. He's still my guy. People say if you could bring back any comic in the world, living or dead, or especially dead, because why would you bring them back if they're already alive? I would say Carlin's my number one guy. I would love to know what George Carlin thinks of the crazy shit we live in now. I mean, I would love to know what Carlin thinks of Trump. That's just, he loses his mind. I don't know how he would respond to it. But, and Carlin was one of those guys that, man, you had to be on your toes. You could not.
Even as a journalist.
Oh, as a journalist. Yeah. No, when you interviewed him, he demanded that you record the interviews, which I always did. Yeah. But he wanted to be quoted exactly, which I get.
Yeah.
And Carlin's a wordsmith. He was, you know, that's one of the reasons I've always loved him. He's a word guy.
Yeah.
And when he practices his routines down to the letter, and he gets them perfect. And I always respected that about him. I remember one year, I completely forgot I was interviewing him one year. And I was just trying to like fucking wing it.
Yeah.
And he ate my lunch. He was nice about it, but it was just like, oh dude, I'll never ever do that again. Yeah. I gotta know what the hell I'm talking, because I was just trying to ask like the stupid, you know, vague question. So what have you been up to? You know, that kind of bullshit. You're just like, so you don't have no idea what the hell I'm up to, do you? And I'm like, no, I don't.
Was that like, you already interviewed him?
I interviewed him multiple times.
Oh, okay.
And Carlin, you know, Carlin had a Fort Worth.
Oh, I could just walk right into this one.
Yeah. Carlin had a Fort Worth connection. He was a DJ here in town at KXOL. And so he had a long time relationship with Fort Worth. So he loved performing here in Fort Worth. And he'd always, you know, he did Dallas, but he'd come back to Fort Worth a lot. So he performed Bass Hall. I think I took Kyle on his birthday to see Carlin's what ended up being his very last show. He passed away like a few months, like 2 or 3 months
this,
after the show we
was
saw
this
Bass Hall.
New Year's Eve, or close to, because that was the one time I thought I might be able to see him. Was I think New Year's Eve, 2002 or 2003, something like that.
I don't think it was New Year's Eve,
because I believe it was on New Year's Eve, and he was going to be at Bass Hall, and I asked my mom. Right, you know, somewhere around the early 2000s, you know, and just because it was New Year's Eve and like the traffic and God knows what's happened on the road, I wasn't able to go.
Yeah,
but that was like the one time I was like cognizant that he was in town and I could possibly go, but I never did.
Yeah,
and
he was, you know, one of the greats, and that was always the thing. I had interviewed so many comics. A lot of comics would come to town and perform locally, and then they would do like radio gigs, and I would occasionally go and sit in with them while they were, you know, doing their banter with a morning radio crew, and then
which every comic loves doing.
Absolutely. But I saw some, I mean, Martin Mull came through.
Oh,
he was
hell yeah.
Absolutely hilarious. And Richard Lewis and a bunch of the, you know, the early guys that I just grew up watching and loved, and then some of the newer guys too as well. But yeah, meeting somebody like, you know, Steve Martin or Martin Short or especially Robin Williams, that was, you know, I interviewed him on The Fisher King. So it was a one-on-one interview where he was everything that I ever wanted him to be. He just, I mean, I asked like one question and then, you know, 45 minutes later, it was like, thank you. You have made my life. I have other questions, but I don't care.
Yeah, it seems useless.
We didn't talk about the movie at all, but it's cool. It was awesome.
I got what I wanted.
Exactly.
Hopefully my bosses will
put on a private show for me personally. That's all I really cared about.
Man. And from all that, you're still just like, you know what? Let's see what the local comics have. Like, Jesus Christ, man. What is wrong with you?
Dude, I can tell
you. I know. You
back in those days, especially percussions, when Kyle and I were newbies and we were learning what it meant to how to host a show, for starters. Neither one of us was professional comedians, so we were really professional hosts. And watching the process, and I still am fascinated by that. That's why I love open mics. I would watch a comic do the same joke every week for 2 months, and I would notice every single change they made to the joke. It would usually be a word, a turn of phrase, whatever. Josh Johnson, a good friend of ours, I watched him develop just one joke until he got it perfect. And it was, you know, that's it gave me insight into how the guys that I truly adored, like Carlin, who would do that. I mean, just show after show after show after show and change one little tiny fragment until it was absolute perfection. And so I was always fascinated by that process. I never got bored with hearing the same material again and again because I knew that they were always honing something. They're always changing it, making better. And, you know, other comics would give them tags and occasionally Kyle and I would give them tags. It was just like, it was just fun. It was such
tags
great...
can come from anywhere.
Absolutely. But it was just amazing. It was amazing to watch the process. I truly miss those days because there were some people that I thought were just incredible talents that are still working, still doing it. A few that kind of gave it up, unfortunately. Tyler Moore is another one that I just mourn the loss of because, god damn, he was funny as a comic.
Oh, yeah,
just
he was...
one of those. He could show up absolutely hammered and kill. I was just like, god, I hate you.
Professional drinker.
Yes.
And
partier. Just
you know,
slay and win.
The punk rock background. He's like, this is fucking nothing to me, man.
Yeah. Which made him funnier. It was just like, I don't care. I don't give a shit if you don't laugh.
It's like, I fucking played, you know, while people are fucking throwing their arms around. Like,
absolutely.
This is, I stand still on
this
stage.
This is easy. You
people
are
laugh.
Polite.
Yeah.
Nobody's even thrown a bottle at me once.
Yeah. Oh, this is fucking amateurs. Yeah. Those were some times. And like, you know, from that group, that core group, plenty of people just trailed off. Some people just like stopped doing stand up.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are still kicking around. Me, I'm probably the more active, I say active as in like I physically show up in front of people's faces, you know, just because I like to get out. There's still comics that are kind of like homebodies, but still fucking, you know, really killing out there. Scott Crisp, destroying it.
Crisp.
Our buddy Grant Redman,
mm-hmm.
who doesn't really do stand up these days, but he's been in commercials, he has an agent, he's been in some TV shows,
mm-hmm.
and just one of the most gregarious, vivacious people you could meet. Had a great stand-up set, but just didn't care about. I get the comedy grind is not for everybody because like there's too many late weeknights. I have a 9-to-5 or something like that, and it's like this also just sucks too much more than it's really fun. Now me, I'm a guy that likes to have some fun. Don't like to get too crazy because I like to continue to have fun.
Right.
I don't need any like massive legal or, you know, medical setbacks that prevent said future fun.
True.
So I like, you know, I live life at I call it a slow burn. And but then some people, it's just like, this fucking comedy bullshit's not for me. But they're still incredibly talented that they find their right avenue, like Grant has done. You know, I'm like, an agent auditions. Now that's a whole different grind. Probably, you know, still sucks in general. I understand that. But, you know, it's, you know, much harder in like New York and L.A. But hey, there's plenty of commercial work in DFW. I have a buddy that, you know, friends that are in the film industry.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and they've worked with Grant. And that's what's crazy is like, you worked with my buddy Grant and, you know, my name happened. They're like, your name was brought up on there. I was just like, fuck yeah. All right. Yeah, I know both these guys.
We had a few people like from those days go, they went on to a sitcom and there's somebody, was one of our regulars went on to a sitcom. Matt McGinnis. What was his name? He used to work at the Star Telegram. Bald dude, glasses, moved to L.A., name completely fell out of my head.
Oh, I'm blanking on that.
Agee. Yeah, Mark Agee.
Mark Agee.
He went to L.A., but there was somebody that...
You said glasses. I'm like, I do not picture him. He may have worn glasses.
Maybe
could have said muscular. That would have been a great tell.
I didn't want to like give away that I thought he was kind of hot.
You're not the only one.
There were a lot of comics I thought were kind of hot.
He was
which
the bald,
is weird because like,
guy.
Comics as a group are not considered to be sex symbols. But we had a lot of sexy comics. You know, Chris Darden is another looker.
Oh yeah, that motherfucker. He'll pop into town. I will randomly see him, and I'll devote 30 seconds to being angry at him for not telling me he's in town.
Exactly.
When I would definitely drop everything I'm doing
to
hang out with him that night.
And I always run into him in the most random places,
right. Yeah,
you know, like a restaurant or something. And
then
I'm like, my God,
I'm angry. But then immediately, like, he smiles. I'm just like, dude, what's up? And we hug and, you know, and then catch up for the next few hours. And then he goes back to New York Or he's doing the last time I saw he's doing mostly sketch and like improv work. Mm-hmm. We'll do some stand up here and there, but if you want to do stand up in New York, you got to devote all the time to that.
Absolutely.
And some people just are like, fuck.
Yeah,
that.
You're going up against some of the best.
You're going against people who will sacrifice a lot.
Absolutely.
Living, living somewhere or feeding themselves. You want to talk about hungry young comics? There's some in New York.
They're literally hungry. Yeah.
Who are so hungry, they're going to steal from bodegas to get by and sleep on a various amount of couches.
Absolutely.
And God knows do what else to just survive. But Darton, yeah, he's one of those guys that's just, you're just like, you likable motherfucker. I wish I could be likable in any way, but let's talk about it. So also on this list here, not just a fan of comics, aka comedians, but also comic books, graphic novels. Now this is something I'm not really in tune with that. Mm-hmm. I'll see a Marvel movie every once in a while, but what's your, you definitely like those.
My original goal when I was a kid, I mean, my dream was to be a cartoonist. That was what I honestly wanted to be when I grew up.
Like a Bill Almond. I read Foxtrot as a kid.
Absolutely.
So that's
mine was Charles Schulz. I grew up reading Peanuts and I used to copy the Peanuts characters and I got it down pretty well. But I'll
put some tracing paper on top of it.
Absolutely.
And just get it.
And then I finally learned how to do it myself. But then when I got to high school, my dad talked me into, we had kind of a quasi monthly paper in high school, which I worked for, but he said, why don't you, we had it in the journalism department. We had a bulletin board that faced the hallway and it was behind glass. So you'd open it up and put stuff on it and close it so people couldn't yank it off or whatever. So I would post, a comic strip on it every day. And he said, you should do that. So you get used to drawing a daily comic strip, and which was great advice. And so I started, I had a comic strip called Calvin the Cal Allen Wildcat. I went to Cal Allen High School. And when I got to TCU, I started a daily strip there called the Campus Underground. And that led me into editorial cartoons. And I really wanted to do cartoons and pursued it for a long time. And then when I got to the Star Telegram, I started doing cartoons for them. I met Mike Price, who was the film critic, and he approached me about illustrating a graphic novel. So he was doing a graphic novel for an old movie from 1962 called Carnival of Souls, and he wanted me to illustrate it. And so I'd never done anything for comic books before. I was a comic strip artist, I was an editorial cartoonist. So the idea of working on a graphic novel was intimidating as hell to me. But I was like, okay, I'm game. I'll try it out. And I was a huge fan of an artist named Drew Friedman, who did these heavy pointillist kind of, hyper parodies of celebrities and stuff. He's done a bunch of stuff about old Jewish comics and all kinds of stuff. He did these super detailed pointillistic portraits of old comedians and things. And I was enamored with his style at the time. So I was like, I'm going to do this whole thing pointillism style, which is like, lots of little dots. All the shading would be, these various shades of dots, which was the stupidest fucking idea I could ever have done. So not only had a very short turnaround time for this thing, but I had a lot of pages. This is a full graphic novel. But it came out, I had to while I was working on it, I had to soak my hands in ice water and then hot water so I could keep,
Strain on the hand.
Yeah, it was, it killed me. But the book came out well, and Mike and I had a long-time collaboration. We did several comic books. We did one called A Holiday for Screams, which is a lot of horror comics. I was a big horror comic guy, so I grew up reading, the old EC horror comics, like Tales from the Crypt and The Vault of Horror, and that was kind of in my wheelhouse. I was never a superhero guy. I never read any superhero comics. I am a huge Marvel fan. I mean, I've seen all the movies in the theater, but never read a single comic. I mean, I was just not into that world. Comics was like a huge part of my life. I did it forever. At one point, I had 6 different cartoons going at one time.
Wow.
Which was crazy. I started working for the gay papers, and I had a gay comic strip and editorial cartoon, and then I did a full page, you know, thing that was kind of my salute to Little Nemo, the old comic strip from the 1900s. And, but yeah, it was crazy. And now I don't do anything. I don't draw shit. So every time I do something, I have to kind of like relearn how to draw again. But it's something I miss doing it. It's definitely a muscle, and it will atrophy if you don't work it regularly. But I kind of just focus more on the word biz. So,
and now with you're not really doing anything now. You have to bring it all back around. There's behind us are tons of totes. Is this the stuff that you're archiving? Or
no, this is all this these. I had a pipe burst on Christmas Day.
That's right. Yes.
And it just doused two bookcases worth of books. So I lost about 180 books.
Damn.
And a lot of that stuff is comic related stuff. So it's, and again, I'm into the obscure kind of, you know, darker edged comics. I was a huge fan of Charles Adams, the guy that invented the Adams family, and my entire Charles Adams collection just obliterated, just gone. And that's, you know, those are like, each one of those books is like 40-50 bucks a piece, so that was devastating. But it's, you know, I'm a huge fan of Edward Gorey, who's another illustrator. Thank God all that stuff was upstairs, none of it was affected. But thankfully I still got a lot of my good stuff, but that's in the process of, you know, dealing with insurance companies and stuff.
Speaking of your house, as much as this is an audio-only podcast, this is a fascinating house, which I've only been here one time because you used to, at one of your epic Halloween parties.
Oh, you came to A Nightmare Before Christmas?
It was like a neon radiation retro.
Oh, yeah. That was our...
That theme.
Right.
Whatever year that theme was.
That was the, nuclear.
There we go.
The nuclear one, yeah. 50s kind of nuclear
what
thing.
What were those about? Just
we started that, guy, when Doug and I lived in an apartment, we started it. It was the year after, or, you know, right during the time Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas came out. And we started a party, and we called it the Nightmare Before Christmas because we didn't want to have a Halloween party because everybody has a fucking Halloween party and you have to compete with everybody's Halloween parties. So we had it in November between Halloween and Christmas. So I think we did one at the apartment and then we moved to this house. And so we did 19 more.
It wasn't a Halloween party. It just felt like an epic Halloween.
It was
party.
A costume party. But
yeah.
So the first 3 or 4 years, it was Halloween / Christmas themed. And then we came up with the idea like, well, let's add a secondary theme so that people will have different costume ideas. So we did the Old West, we did Go-Go, we did Under the Sea, Tiki. We did a lot of really fun ones that superheroes and villains. This inspired some pretty amazing cartoons over the years. But we'd have like 250, 300 people at the house. And, you know, a big yard, so we had all these people everywhere. Doug would... And my late husband was just an amazing artist in his own right. He was a dancer, but also a three-dimensional artist. He graduated that TCNU. So he would create these amazing props in the yard. I remember one year we did Freak Show was the theme. So I painted like these huge Freak Show banners and stuff that we had hanging in the yard. So it became like this, this kind of Algonquin round table of weirdos. It was like all the people from the different worlds that we inhabited, because I was, so all my theater friends, all my journalism friends, all his dancer friends, all his bike, you know, his bike rider, he was in Knight Riders. And so it was just all this huge mix of just crazy people who would never interact with one another on a regular basis. And they would get together. People still talk about it. I still have people come up to me all the time like, I think I went to a Halloween party in this neighborhood. It's like, yeah, it was my house.
Yeah.
But it was, those were good times. But you know, we did it for 20 years, and we were both like, I'm done.
That's a good run.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's 20 is a nice round number. We're done.
No one can fault you for hanging up those hats.
Yeah, people still try to bring it back though. I'm still toying with the idea. It's like I need a committee because I cannot do this shit by myself.
Yeah,
I created these very elaborate invitations for them. You know, we did comic books one year. It looked like a little golden book because it was fairy tales was the theme. And so I would come up with these really, you know, very elaborate little creative books and stuff. The one that you went to was one of my favorite because it looked like the old Duck and Cover book with a turtle that, you know, goes into a shell because a nuclear bomb's going off. Like, that's going to protect him. Like, getting under your desk is
like
going to protect
you
in school.
The game Fallout.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So, you have various, like I said, when I walked in here, your house could be a museum.
Yeah.
And because you just have, you have your Edward Gorey room.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, you said the tiki room, right?
Yeah. The bathroom is all tiki themed. Tiki, yeah.
Which I've used twice.
We're sitting here in the living room under the gazing eyes of a lot of doll heads sitting on top of my cabinet.
Oh, thanks for pointing that out. I think I didn't see that.
In case you weren't freaked out or creeped out in any way. Yeah.
No, just minorly. You also have, one thing, I learned later, early on, is your utter devotion to the band, foreshadow devotion to Devo.
Absolutely.
Hey, that came off the dome.
There you go.
So what,
right off the old energy, John.
You're a super fan.
I
to
am.
To say the least.
I actually pondered the idea of changing my middle name to Devo when I was in high school.
Oh.
I was that much of a nerd. And, Devo is, it's funny because I was at a work meeting, an all-day work meeting yesterday, and the question, they did like an icebreaker question for everybody in the room, and I was like, what was your first concert? And the first concert I went to my parents with was Kenny Rogers, but the first concert I got to pick was Devo. And it's like, that gives you an idea of the differential in our household of what I liked versus what my parents liked. And I like country music. I'm an old-school country music fan, like the oldies guys. But no, Devo was like, Devo spoke to me in a different way. And I, after Doug died, I started going to, they have a convention in Cleveland called the Devotional. And they bring a bunch of cover bands and stuff and sell merch. And then, you know, some of the guys that are still around will show up. And so last year I got to meet Mark Mothersbaugh, who's the lead singer of Devo, which was like a lifelong dream for me. So I have a picture of Mark, who was shit-faced at the bar and just hanging all over me. And we're like just goofing in front of the cameras. Just like, those are some of my most cherished photographs ever.
That's awesome. Well, they say never meet your heroes, but
absolutely.
You, no, this whole podcast has been a reason to meet your heroes.
I've never been disappointed by my heroes.
Experience. I'd be like, I met Steve Martin. It was amazing. I met Carl. It was amazing. I met Devo is amazing. Well, fuck it. Meet your heroes. If it sucks, then whatever. You met them and you learned a lesson about
life.
Well,
don't approach them in like a urinal in a bathroom and you probably won't have a bad experience.
Make
you know,
the setting.
I was you know,
correct.
At an event that was appropriate to meet them. So,
so you're a cataloger, I would say. Naturally, an
some
archivist.
People call it a hoarder, I think.
You can walk around here. No.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you have storage units galore that no one knows the location of.
Oh, I do. I have two storage units. But
they're
both
they're
very
for.
Organized. Yeah.
Oh, see. Okay.
One is all gay history stuff. So I like I said, with Yesterqueer, I'm building an archive. So I do have one whole
now,
storage unit.
That could and should be like a legit museum.
That and
then
we
point.
Are talking
a space,
about that.
Good. Okay, cool.
Because I would, that's something, you know, I would love to just buy like a small house and turn it into like a little miniature LGBTQ history museum for Fort Worth. And there's definitely enough material. I mean, I definitely have enough stuff. That's something that, you know, once we get a 501c3, I will start, you know, avidly pursuing grants and things like that. Because that's a very hot topic right now with charitable organizations. So I'm hoping to definitely get some of that stuff on display, because I think it needs to be seen. A lot of people would be fascinated by it.
Oh,
got some
absolutely.
Cool stuff.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully there's like a place in this neighborhood, you know, which is near dear to your heart. You live here, Lysa.
I would love to get one. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and there, you know, there's properties around here. You probably get a space, and maybe you know, who knows? Maybe something on Jennings will open up. Yeah, who knows? Or hell, maybe your house could, you know,
exactly.
maybe get a sweet tax break if, you know.
Yeah, I turned my house into a museum, then I moved into a smaller place. It'd be nice. Someplace without stairs when I can't climb stairs anymore.
Oh, yeah, you got to think about that.
Absolutely.
You are graying. So. But, all right, anything before we wrap this up you want to touch on? Check out Yesterqueer, anyone listening.
Yeah, we have a Facebook group. Which is Yesterqueer FW, and we're also on Instagram. And we have a website coming up soon, which will be yesterqueerfw.com. That should be launching probably within the next few weeks.
My brain hears that and naturally thinks DFW, because that's just how you hear it growing up here. But Yesterqueer FW.
Absolutely. So we do a monthly happy hour. So the next one will be April 19th.
At Liberty Lounge.
At Liberty Lounge. We'll be talking about the history of LGBTQ youth organizations, and Sharon Herrera, the leader of LGBTQ Saves, will be my guest. So those are always fun. I mean, it's educational. You can have a cocktail, you learn something, meet people. It's a great way to spend a Wednesday night. So,
oh,
there you go.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, Todd, thank you so much, my man.
Thank you, Brian. This was a pleasure. Fun.
And I know you could probably spend way more time on various other subjects, but I like to take into account the attention span most people have these days.
Yeah.
It's a 2-3 hour podcast. That's for the Rogans.
30 or 40 minutes ago, so it's cool.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, they stuck around to the end. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
Love you, buddy. You too. This is great. And your house is fascinating to this day. All right. Guys, check out, thanks for listening to the Breckening Podcast. Download it if you can. Spotify, Apple, whatever. Come see me do stand-up. Check out my social media if you want to do that. Dates are whenever they happen. Y'all have a great day.